the cases began. Have both counsel received our written statement of procedures for oral argument? Do either of you have any questions? With that in mind, there now we have a number of spectators in the audience. If any of you has a cell phone, would you please turn it off so that the lawyers aren't interrupted? Otherwise, we're ready for argument in Marriage of Gould.
Your Honor, Stephen Epstein, one question. Are parties permitted at the council table, Your Honor?
Well, I'm not sure we've got a rule on that, but they're welcome to sit there.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to present oral argument. At council table is Eric Gold, the appellant in this matter and the respondent on the trial level, as well as Nathan Dowell, one of our attorneys. Your Honor, I believe that error has been confessed. Judge Russell made a number of findings of fact, made findings as to dissipation, which Ms. Gold admits her error. The $30,000 that Judge Russell found to be dissipated. Well, upon examination, it's clear that Mr. Gold accounted for that. In fact, it was a stipulated $15,000 going to each party, which constitutes the 30 so-called dissipated. So Ms. Gold says, oh, we'll correct that error. Then there was another error. The judge found that Mr. Gold was in arrears for $2,000 a month for 7 months. Therefore, the court ordered Mr. Gold owes $53,000. Your Honors, as a society, we have chosen an adversarial system. And our system requires that every player in that system do their part. I think Mr. Kaplan litigated this conscientiously and to the best of his ability. I'd like to think that my firm represented Mr. Gold conscientiously and to the best of our ability. Unfortunately, the system only works if everyone does their part. In this instance, although Judge Russell is a fine man and has put in a lot of good years on the bench, he abdicated his role. Judge Russell instructed both parties to submit forms of order. Judge Russell chose to adopt wholesale, almost verbatim, 95 to 98% verbatim, from the form of the order proposed by Mrs. Gold. As we've briefed, hopefully extensively, when a court adopts the form of the order of one of the parties, then this court's scrutiny must be heightened. In this case, Your Honor, the evidence of abdication and error is best indicated by the adoption of Mrs. Gold's error. Your Honor, none of this is really surprising if a judge is not going to critically review what's submitted to him or her. Mr. Kaplan, of course, is going to contain legal argument in the so-called form of order. The legal argument, as the honors know, is not always supported by the facts or the law. Lawyers on closing try to present things in the light most favorable to the client. In Mr. Kaplan's closing, adopted by the court, certain things were present which clearly are wrong. We can see on its face. Your Honor, the biggest error here relates to the business valuation. Now, the business valuation is very, very important because, as noted in the dissent in Banning and noted in the expert testimony in this court, the fact that there's value is a fiction. Mr. Gold cannot sell his business. He cannot pledge the business as security to get loans. Mr. Gold has a business which only permits him to continue to work. Now, all a business valuation is a prediction of future income based on past performance reduced to present value. So all a business valuation is, simply, is we take a look at the last 3, 4, 5 years, we make an assumption that that's going to continue, and voila, we have a business valuation. Now, the formula for these business valuations are set forth in Huff. Huff is the seminal case. Mr. Huff was a lawyer at HRO. Mr. Huff had a buy-sell, internal buy-sell, for $42,000. The partners at HRO were going to pay him $42,000 if he left the firm. The trial court said no. In Huff, there's value to the HRO partnership greater than what the buy-sell says. So they came up with the formula. And they adopted it actually from a case out of New Jersey called Dubin. And this is what the excess earnings formula used by the court in Huff and by Judge Russell says. An excess earning is the amount by which an individual earns more money than a similarly situated individual. Banning says that can even be an employee of the same company. So what we have to do, because these business valuations are theoretical, and in a declining economy, we know that the future is not going to look like the past. But at any rate, because this is so important, the first step is to decide, well, what is Mr. Gold's income? Now, what's interesting is Judge Russell in his order says he finds nothing persuasive to make him deviate from the opinion by Brian Campbell, the joint expert. That's what he says. And then in the next moment, he uses Yvonne Zuber, another expert, computation of income. So what he's doing is he says he's adopting the Campbell report with an income level of $201,000, but then he bases child support and maintenance, and it's not clear whether he based the business valuation as well, upon a finding by Ms. Zuber of $300,000. This is after the court already said it's eschewing all the expert testimony except for that of Mr. Campbell. So the first issue
is that inconsistent when evaluating the value of a business as opposed to evaluating someone's future income.
Your Honor, it's all driven by the same number. And what we're doing is we take a look at present income, we compare that to the past income, and then there are assumptions made about the income going forward. If the assumption, well, what's odd here in this case is we know that the assumptions are wrong. But if the assumption about future income is based on an erroneous calculation of present income, then that prediction is necessarily going to be skewed. Now, Mr. Campbell opined that the income was about $200 a year. Mr. Schuster, Mr. Gold's expert, opined it was
now, is that income or salary?
Your Honor, that is complete income. And income for self-employed individuals is defined as gross receipts minus reasonable and necessary expenses. And this brings me up to a little sideline. Mr. Gold testified that he leaves about $40,000 in the bank at any one time. He's got a business that he's got waxes and wanes, he's got employees, he's got the brokers he manages, he's got the staff people, he's got rent. Well, what the court sort of found was that that money left in the coffers as a cushion should be counted as income to him. Well, it wasn't distributed, and even though it's an S corporation and it's passed through, what's gone on here is that there's been a double dipping. What happens is there's money left in the corporation at the end of the year. Because it's an S-Corp, whether it's distributed or not, it passes through to Mr. Gold. So he's, for example, so he's taxed in 07 on money left in the business. Then the following year it's distributed to him, but Judge Russell called that income, which is a double dip.
Did he call it income in both years?
He called it income in both years, and that was the problem. He called it income in the year that it was booked as income, as pass-through income, and then he booked it again as income in the following year. Now, what's odd here now also is, Your Honors, there's a multiplier. Let me finish my presentation. So we have what Mr. Gold makes. Then we got to compare, and we don't know whether it's 200 or 300. Then we've got to compare him to a similarly situated individual.
Well, just to clarify, is the primary difference between the 200 and 300 in your example the double counting of retained earnings?
There's 40 of it, which we think is double counting of retained earnings. The other aspect of it was a SEP contribution, I believe. And the SEP contribution had already been distributed to both parties, and we figured that that should be out of the equation. Furthermore, there was no evidence that the SEP contribution would have been able to be made in future years, because at the time of the trial, the commercial real estate market had already started to decline.
This is going to really disappoint you, but what's a SEP contribution?
Self-employment pension.
Oh, okay.
And it's a pre-tax distribution. into sort of a sheltered fund, what's a pre-tax and works like an IRA. So the first thing that where there's error is what's Mr. Gold's income? One expert said it's 200. The expert whom the judge purportedly ostensibly relied upon, another expert said it was 300, and our expert said it was about 202. Then we've got to compare Mr. Gold to similarly situated workers. Now, Mr. Gold specializes in commercial real estate. He's been doing it for over 20 years in a metropolitan area of about 2 million Boulder, Denver, in the southern suburbs. Mr. Schuster, and our argument was that Mr. Gold should be compared to veterans in commercial real estate in, I guess, the second tier cities, in addition to being simply a commercial real estate broker. Mr. Gold wears other hats. He wears the hat as a manager of the associate brokers. He also wears the hat as the manager of the business. So the question is who is it appropriate to compare Mr. Gold to? Mr. Campbell compared Mr. Gold not to similarly situated people, but rather to all the commercial realtors.
But didn't he account for that, or to some extent, by picking the 60th or the 65th percentile rather than the median?
Your Honor, here's the problem with that. First of all, Huff is clear that we're using the median. And that is a clear dictate with the assumption that it's going to be a median of similarly situated earners. If, and I believe Mr. Campbell said that for 07, a comparable wage would be $160,000, okay? But, Your Honor, we look at what similarly situated individuals make, and it's far in excess of the $160,000.
What specific database did you put before the lower court that shows what you call similarly situated as opposed to Mr. Campbell's broader industry averages?
Number one, we brought in expert testimony via the experts from Fuller & Company. Fuller & Company is the biggest, one of the most prestigious, along with Ross, commercial real estate companies in town. We had testimony through the experts that for an individual such as Mr. Gold, he would be receiving approximately 70% of the gross commissions he generated. If we apply that 70% to his gross, then he comes in at about $250,000, and the excess earnings vanishes. The second thing we did, Your Honor, Banning dealt with a closed corporation, and one of the officers in the closed corporation was going through a divorce. What Banning said is you can compare Mr. Banning to other executives in the same company or other employees. Banning actually used the term employees, and this was in the general opinion, not in the special concurrence, and the special occurrence is very instructive. So anyway, the second database we used was Mr. Gold's own top producer. He's got a gentleman who's been there for many, many years, who is, because he brings in a certain amount of gross, earns 70% as an employee. So the issue is it fair, is it reasonable that an employee makes more or should make more than the owner? Why would that occur? An owner should make at least as much as his employees.
What remedy do you propose that we implement? Do we remand for more findings pointing out where you consider the existing findings to be in error?
Your Honor, I think a new trial is in order, and here's why. We've got 8 or 10 little errors, from valuing assets which don't exist to a finding that Ms. Gold's separate property increased from approximately $19,000 to $72,000 during the course of the hearing. We have a dependency exemption, and this is on the record, but it wasn't an issue. The statute says the dependency exemptions shall be allocated in proportion to the party support of the children. There's a finding that Mr. Gold makes $25 a month. Mrs. Gold makes about $2,500, a maintenance transfer of 6, that puts her at 85 and puts him at 19. That's greater than a 2-to-1 ratio. As a matter of law, the trial court erred in just dividing the exemptions equally. That's one example. Attorney's fees. Your Honor, 119 is the attorney's fee statute. It requires the court, before allocating fees, to make specific findings. And one thing the court just said, the economic circumstances are such that he should pay fees. But if the court takes a close look at this order, the effect of this order is confiscatory. And I seem about done, and I meant to spend time for rebuttal, but I won't be able to. It's confiscatory. Let's start both parties at $850,000 or thereabouts, okay? Of the $850,000 that Mr. Gold has, $350,000 or $400,000 approximately is the business value, which we know he can't sell. Now, so he's down to, say, in real assets, down to about $450,000 or $500,000.
Your time is up, counsel, so
thank you, Your Honor.
Wrap up in a sentence if you could.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. I'm Mark Kaplan. I'm here on behalf of Robin Gold, who's seated with me. I'd like to start with the question you asked, Judge Webb, which is, what's the remedy that that we're seeking? And this is an unusual case in one respect. We filed a Rule 60 motion that has never been ruled upon by the trial court. There's no, not like 59J, where you have a 60-day period and it's deemed denied. Rule 60, I think, still stays. But the court loses jurisdiction when there's an appeal, and so I believe the rule clearly says if once this court remands it to the trial court can still rule on a Rule 60 motion. I think that's the proper remedy here, because really all that's at issue that can be found to be, quote, error are the things that have been conceded by Mrs. Gold. In other words, the $30,000 error, she asked the judge to correct the miscalculation of the arrearages in the maintenance. She asked the judge to correct. Those are things that are not in dispute that she attempted to remedy by filing a Rule 60 motion, which can still be remedied by a remand from this court for the purpose of ruling on that motion. Everything else that is being appealed that Mrs. Gold does dispute should not be reversed. This isn't a situation where they should get a second bite of the apple. This is a situation where we should get a good, correct ruling. And what has happened is they have taken these mathematical mistakes or these concepts that are not in dispute and are trying to say, well, therefore, throw the whole thing out and let's start over. This was 4 days of trial and a divorce. The judge changed my proposed order. He didn't just sign it, and even if he had just signed it, there's no evidence that that's wrong.
Well, what substantive provisions did he change?
Well, first he changed the value of the Kenyon real estate, the property. Kenyon LLC is a limited partnership holding real estate, and there was a stipulation for $60,000. The judge changed it to $44,000 based upon Mr. Gold's argument. That's one substantive change. He changed the amount and the duration of maintenance. He changed the amount of attorney's fees. He changed some things that, and I have to go through piece by piece, but he changed some things of measure of importance. Now, he didn't change everything by a long shot, but that's not my fault for submitting an order that attempted to be based on the evidence. I mean, you know, if I was overreaching, the judge should have written his own order or cut and paste or done something, but if I wasn't overreaching, what's wrong with him making small changes? There isn't any evidence in the record to suggest that either my proposed order or the actual permit orders were not based on at least some evidence. And really all they're saying is, well, we don't agree with his conclusions. We don't agree with how he exercised his discretion. He should have gone with Mr. Schuster, who said there was a $10,000 increase in value of this business during 17 years of marriage. He should have gone with Mr. Schuster with the income attributable to Mr. Gold, as opposed to going with Mr. Campbell and as opposed to going with my hired expert as well. So really, I think what they're trying to do is say, throw out the baby with the bathwater. And we've tried, by filing that Rule 60 motion, to address the mathematical mistakes that we agree should be correct. There are a couple points here, though, that I think that Mr. Epstein made that I really don't think are supported by the record. The first is that the capitalization of earnings method is somehow faulty because Mr. Campbell used the median off these different surveys. The evidence is really up to the judge to decide what's credible. He heard from three different experts on what was a reasonable compensation for someone in Mr. Gold's field. And record is full of argument. We spent days with these experts going over, well, does this median income include management? Does it include sales? Does it include doing the bills? What does it include? And so the judge heard a lot of information about what Mr. Gold did for a living, what other people from a statistical point of view make for doing that kind of work. He heard three different opinions and he arrived at one. And I don't see any error that Mr. Epstein has pointed to that's supported by the record.
What about his assertion that there was double counting, that in this the same retained earnings was charged as income in two succeeding years?
I disagree entirely with that statement. First of all, in the permanent orders, and I apologize, I don't have the record reference, but it's page 3 of the permanent orders. I'll quote. It says, Mr. Campbell testified he did not add into his value any cash in the business in excess of what typically was held by the business, which would have increased the value of the business had he done so. Mr. Campbell testified, unquote, Mr. Campbell testified that he did not include the cash over and above what was normally held. So he didn't add it to the value of the business. There was no double dip. And he took 07 income. He didn't take 07 and 08 or 07 and 06. He took 07. It's whatever was left in the business. And 14.10.115, and I hate this statute because it has so many subparts, but it's 1, actually it's not 1. It's under the determination income section 5. And it's so hard to read this, but it looks like it's 2. C and D3A. But basically what it says in our 14.10.115 are two things which are very important. One's in my brief for sure, which talks about how the taxable distributions are to be included as income. And the specific language in here talks about, actually I was a little low on this. It's actually 5.1 W, and it says taxable distributions from general partnerships, limited partnerships, closely held corporations, or limited liability companies. It's included in income. Then there's another section which says that further down, my previous reference, which says that if for income from self-employment, rent, royalties, proprietorship of a business. Doesn't say any kind of, it's just a proportion of a business. Gross income equals gross receipts minus ordinary necessary expenses. So under either provision, the judge has the discretion to include the cash that the business generates as income for the person who owns it as a sole proprietor, as in Mr. Gold's case, or if he treats it as a taxable distribution, which he also does since it's a subchapter S. So I don't agree that it's double dipping. I don't see anywhere in the record where the judge included that income in the value, because he used Mr. Gold's value. Had he gone with Mr. Schuster's value, that would have been different, but he didn't. Mr. Schuster included that income as part of the assets. Now, how he did it, I don't know, when he comes up with $10,000 of marital value when there's $40,000 sitting in the bank, but nonetheless, that's what he came up with. This reference to Fuller and Company, the record shows that Mr. Gold called the same people at Fuller that Mr. Schuster did. Everybody did a reality check, so to speak, on the data to make sure that this was in fact what the market was showing in Denver. They didn't just rely on statistics. They actually called a competitor and said, what are you paying people to do this kind of work? Mr. Campbell testified he did that. So it's not as though the Fuller information is helpful to Mr. Gold. The other, quote, issues that Mr. Epstein suggests are somehow deserving of a remand, it's all discretionary stuff. I mean, I was amazed at reading his brief, because he'd go through and talk about, cite all the law about how it's all within the judge's discretion, how the judge can basically make his rulings if he has any evidence to support it, goes through and just basically makes my argument, and then says, therefore, we want a remand, as opposed to saying, therefore, the judge had discretion to do what he did. I'm happy to answer any specific questions the court has at this time. Otherwise, I'll just start going through some of the arguments in the brief. I do have one point, actually. I think it's a very interesting point, and I neglected to say when I got up here, it's a pleasure to be in front of this panel again. This case doesn't hinge on the Uniform Gift of Minors Act accounts at all. We all know that. But it's an interesting issue, and I don't think one that this court has really addressed head on. We have that Ludwig case, which says that the trial court hasn't have jurisdiction over UGMA accounts because it's the child's money. And I'm not asking the court to reverse that. But the question here is whether the judge had the authority to order one of the parents to be in charge. In other words, have decision making over that child's account. And while we've asked the judge to undo that in our post-trial motion, which hasn't been ruled upon, just because we didn't want to invite error, I nonetheless think that if you're inclined, you can address that, because to me it seems as though a trial court should be able to tell a parent, or the both parents, this, you're going to be in charge of that account, even though it's the child's account.
You concede that issue under Ludwig.
Well, sure we do. Sure, okay. Sure. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal, and we do concede it. We concede all of the quote errors that Mr. Epstein has referred to, the $30,000 that was distributed, the miscalculation of the maintenance arrearages, the I can go through it right now.
Well, let me help you with at least one
yeah,
question.
Sure.
As I understand it, Mr. Gould paid some necessary expenses to facilitate sale of the marital residence.
He did.
And then the court paid him out of the proceeds. And then the court ordered him to pay the wife's share again, which looks to me like he had to pay the wife's share twice.
With all due respect, Your Honor, that's not what happened. And I don't believe that's what the judge found. The evidence was that there were some expenses that were paid out of the marital account paid out of the sale when the house sold. The judge ruled that some, but not all of those expenses, were for things like cleaning the garage, having a lawn mowed, things that Mr. Gould himself should have paid for out of his own pocket.
Why?
And though,
if they're expenses to make the property look saleable, why isn't that a reasonable offset against the gross sale proceeds?
I have two answers for you. Okay. The,
sure.
the technical one is because the judge said so, and he has this, he heard the evidence and decided that in this particular case, under these circumstances, that was not reasonable. But to give you the argument I gave that Judge Russell, I'll give to you, which is that Mr. Gould was living in that house. Mrs. Gould had already moved on to a new house. Mr. Gould had also purchased a new house. So he already had his new house. She had her house. They were selling the marital residence. And so she was incurring those expenses at her house. He was incurring the expenses for his house. Yet he was also living in the marital house and should have been cleaning it up, should have been doing the lawn, should have been using his income to pay for those things, like she was using her income to pay for those things. So
well,
what
he can only live in one house, though.
Right.
So if he lives in his new house, then they'd have to pay somebody to keep the grass cut and et cetera, to make the house that's for sale looking good. So
but
isn't that a split cost?
I don't believe he was living in his new house.
Well, I said he could have.
He could have.
Okay.
I don't think he's. I'll have to double check, but I don't think that he actually closed on that new house at the time that they sold the old one. I'd have to double check that.
I misunderstood what you said.
Yeah, and maybe I'm wrong on that. I can't remember frankly. So I may have misstated it.
Okay.
But the types of expenses that we're talking about were not the type to make the house saleable. Those came out of the marital account and were not adjusted. What the judge did, he took some of those expenses that Mrs. Gould objected to and considered whether those should have been paid out of Mr. Gold's separate income or whether out of they should be paid out of the marital sales proceeds. And if I go to the permanent orders, I will find exactly what those were and then tell
you what. If they're in the permanent orders, you don't have to use your.
Well, yeah. Well, that's okay. It was a portion of those expenses, and it was $2,485, and it was certainly not the entire amount of the costs incurred by this family to sell the house. The realtor commission was shared. Other costs of getting the house together were shared. It was just these specific costs that Mr. Gold tried to shift to the marriage when he should have, according to the trial judge, borne himself.
And he should have, in your view, he should have borne them because he was living in the house?
Yeah, things like, well, you know, why didn't you clean up the garage? Why didn't you mow the lawn? Why didn't you do these things? Why should she have to pay for that while you're living in that house? And that's what we asked the judge to consider, and he said, yeah, you're right. Now, some other expenses, and I don't have the itemization here, but I know it's in the record, other expenses were shared. And so there's really no evidence, I don't think, that the judge abused his discretion in reaching this conclusion. My time's up. Any other questions?
Your time's up.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. Counsel are excused. The case stands submitted, and we will issue a written opinion in due course. That concludes our afternoon docket, and the bailiff may announce a recess.